Call the House State Affairs Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, April 22nd, 1991. The time is 8:36. We have a quorum, Representatives Moyer, Bruckman, Baker, Grunberg, and Kabina. Today's hearing, we have confirmation hearings on Millie Keller, Commissioner Designate for the Department of Administration. First thing I'd like to do is invite Representative Parnell. Representative Parnell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the committee. This early, I appreciate the opportunity to come over and speak on behalf of a good constituent of mine and Mr. Baker's, a fellow I've known since 1972, almost 20 years. And I first met Millet when he was active in the community and watched him go onto the school board and spend a couple of terms there and then have a successful business, sell that, and run a consulting business and raise a couple of children. And just be a very active, busy member of the community. On the assembly note, it was before us a number of times on budget issues, other issues in the community. And I felt his presentations were always fair and informed, interestingly enough, in contrast to some who had come before us. And in particular, he was forthright and communicated how he felt right off the top, whether it was by phone, in person, or at the assembly level. He was always decent, honest, and respectful. And interestingly enough to me, he's a good man on returning telephone calls, which I find to be a trait that I appreciate very much. So I would like to recommend the committee have an opportunity to speak with him and hear him out. And I would encourage you to seriously consider him as a man of integrity, honesty, and forthrightness.
Thank you, Representative. We have Commissioner Designate Keller take the hot seat this morning. Good morning, Mr. Keller.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Baker.
I would just like to second what Mr. Parnell said. I would be a little more prolific, but in the interest of time, that I too serve with Mr. Keller. And I was an employee of the school district, so I've been on the other side of the field when Mr. Keller served on the school board. So as Betty knows, being there as an employee and looking to the wisdom of the school board members grants you a unique experience, right, Betty?
You're right on, Larry.
So that's when I first met Mr. Keller, and so I would just like to prescribe to the comments that Representative Parnell has just shared with the committee.
Thank you. Good morning.
Morning,
Keller. Putting under Alaska Statute 24.25.060, we're authorized to have you take an oath, but I don't see any real need for that unless you do. Do you?
No, I'll take an oath if you want me to. You know,
I don't
swear me in.
I don't see any need for that either. I just brought to my attention something we could do. My intentions here are to give you some time to sort of tell us about your philosophy and where you would head with the Department of Administration and break it off any questions from the committee. If when we're done with you, if anyone else would like to testify, I'll give them that opportunity. And if there is further questions after that, we may schedule another time, although it may not be necessary. So with that, we might just start off with a little bit of an overview, as you see fit, on your qualifications and where you think that you're going to take us down the road to.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. First of all, let me thank Representative Parnell for those comments. I didn't realize that he was going to do that until he asked me about a week ago if it would be okay for him to do that. I wasn't expecting to be introduced. And I was moved by that because Representative Parnell and I did not always agree on issues when I testified before the Assembly. And I was very very thankful and said that I would be very, very pleased and honored if he would make those remarks, and I'm very touched by what he said. And similarly with Representative Baker, even though we're in the same political party, we haven't always agreed on everything eye to eye, but I think we've always respected each other, and I've always thought that was the one of the great joys of public service, is that even though people with good intentions and with all good motives don't always agree on issues, we tend, once we find out where our areas of disagreement are, we respect each other's opinion.
Excuse me, Mr. Keller, just let me know for the record that we've been joined by Representative Choquette at 8:42. Excuse me.
It's obviously a great honor to be asked by the governor to serve as a commissioner, and also a daunting challenge when you're asked to do that. All of us, I think, that responded to Governor Hickel's call did so because we want to serve the state. Every one of us walked away from something else in our life. In my case, I closed a private business, consulting business. Others left a secure, easy life in after a full life of work and in retirement. Other commissioners walked away from that. All of you have been in public service, obviously, and have recognized that it's not an easy thing to step out of your normal life and go in to serve the public. And one of the things that I've been impressed with is the people that Governor Hickel's brought on as the other commissioners in what that means to me in my ability to be able to try to achieve the governor's goals as far as Department of Administration. I would like to be confirmed as Commissioner of Administration, and I hope that you will see favorably to accept Governor Hickel's nomination of me as Commissioner. I've worked with Governor Hickel on public policy issues for the last 14 years, very closely for 10 of those years on the Commonwealth North Board. We spent years and years meeting every Tuesday morning for an hour and a half to 2 hours, devoting our attention to what we thought was a better future for the state of Alaska. I don't think any of us ever thought that we'd be in the position to actually start trying to implement some of the things that we've worked so long on to develop, but we have that opportunity now, and I think we fully intend to try to implement what we think are the policies that will best serve the state. As far as the Department of Administration, it's been a great learning experience for me. I think I mentioned to each of you that I have never been in Juneau during a legislative session, even though I've lived in Alaska for 27 years. I've never been down here when the legislature was in session. I've spent very little time in any of the departments, certainly nothing in the Department of Administration. So when I came into it, obviously you recognize there's a lot of things to learn, and that's been a challenge. It's part of what I get a great deal of, or see as a great deal of excitement in the job, is the opportunity to learn a great deal. I think I bring a lot of experience, having lived in Alaska for many years, having dealt with public policy issues. I've been privileged to serve in public office and deal with the public from the standpoint of being their representative and understanding what that means, the constitutional obligations of public office, and the actual fulfillment that one gets from public service. I intend, in as much as possible, to bring that same kind of enthusiasm to the Department of Administration. We have a wide variety of challenges, not just the in making sure that the state's accounting machinery and the bureaucratic machinery works, but a lot of programs. In fact, most of our efforts are engaged in programs that serve the public, or certain members or certain sectors of the public, and those are a great challenge. I have told my employees that what I would like to have is I believe that the Department of Administration works well, it delivers what it promises, and it only promises what it can deliver. I think the relationship that we have with the other agencies, the relationship with the legislature are critical to our success, and I hope that we're able to maintain an open relationship. Unfortunately, even my best intentions sometimes go awry. I learned a great lesson from the memo, and I'm sure you'll want to get into that, and I would welcome discussing any aspect of that you'd like to get into. It was clearly something that was misinterpreted. Unfortunately, I talked as soon as I saw the concern that it had raised with Buddy Maupin. I called Buddy and scheduled a meeting with him. We had a very cordial meeting. We also determined, again, in an open environment, open relationship, where our differences are. Obviously, in my judgment, the collective bargaining process tends to focus those differences on the management's rights and the union rights and obligations. I sent a letter to Buddy to make sure that he was aware that in our meeting, I had apologized for any misunderstanding that was my fault in terms of the unfortunate phrase that I used. And I think our relationship, my relationship with Buddy Maupin, has not been injured. In fact, it gave us a relationship, or gave us an opportunity to kind of air some of the things that we're both concerned about. So I think out of it, probably more good has come. Now, if you want to any extent that you want to discuss that, I'm more than happy to do it. I think in closing, I see one of the important things that is going to happen with this administration is a recognition that the future that we're going to have changes in the future. Some big issues that we've pushed out in front of us, primarily in spending, financial type issues, we're going to have to come to grips with, because the state in the 90s, in this decade, isn't going to have the same kind of revenue picture that it's had in the 80s. And I think our spending has to be adjusted to recognize that. I appreciate this opportunity. Be welcome. Welcome any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Color. Let me maybe start off with a few rather general questions, and we'll allow the committee to go whatever direction that they want with it. This year, the governor came in and said that he was going to cut the operating budget. Your position appeared to be to attempt to take approximately a 5% cut. My understanding is that you intend to try to take 5% cut each of these years. Of course, your cuts were not even across the board 5%. You headed in directions that you thought you could cut some places more. Obviously, public radio has been a big issue. Could you give the committee an understanding of where your cuts would come next year and the year after, and try to see where you would want to be at the end of your four-year term as far as cuts in your department? Or you may want to expand on that, because it's obvious to us that you have quite a bit of influence within the government as a whole, and I believe that your recommendations probably go well beyond the Department of Administration. So could you give us some insight into where you might be taking us in that direction?
The governor's plan is to bring the operation of government, the cost of government, the amount we spend on the operation of government, down to $1.7 billion over a four-year period. The magic in the $1.7 billion is that is about the amount of revenue that we get from taxes, licenses, and fees. And it's the governor's belief, and my belief as well, that the operation of government should be funded out of taxes, licenses, and fees. We should not be using our royalty, our wealth income, if you will, to fund the operation of government. Now, that's a public policy call. There are obviously people that will argue exactly the opposite, but that's the overall policy judgment that we've made, is to bring the operation of government down to 1.7. Obviously, we could raise taxes. That would be another alternative to maintain spending on operation at its current level. We've rejected that notion and think that bringing spending down to the existing level of taxes and fees is appropriate. Now, what that means is, obviously, is that to look on the other side of spending, to match the amount of spending on the wealth side, that we've identified that spending should be increased. And that, right now, the wealth income that we have, the primary area that's spent is on the permanent fund. 25 to 35% of the income from our wealth side goes into the permanent fund. In addition to that, we believe that we have identified deferred maintenance as an area that we should be we need to devote some of that wealth income to. We need to devote we think, a substantial part to retiring debt. We see that as a capital expense, and have fashioned a plan that would retire the state's general obligation debt and meet the moral obligation we have for school district debt, the state's share of school district debt. And the final area are in capital projects, which we would see the wealth income of the state being devoted to. Now, how that translates into individual budgets over 4 years is as follows. We started this year with a 5% reduction in the operation of government, and a 5% reduction each year over the 4 years will bring us down to the $1.7 billion overall. This first year, we had, from the time of the election till the governor took office, less than a month to start. We then had about 6 weeks to prepare a budget, a revised budget to present to the legislature. In order to start that 5% reduction process as quickly as possible, we allocated the 5% out to each department. So each department was given the challenge of reducing its budget by an overall 5%. That's obviously not a real desirable way to do it. We intend in the future years to take more time to identify which departments should have larger reductions and which departments should have lesser reductions. But to begin with, each commissioner was given the challenge of reducing 5%. Within the Department of Administration, then, I had to take the 5% and determine how best to allocate that among the programs in the department. I started with the programs that were constitutionally obligated to provide, followed by the programs that were legally obligated to provide, and finally the programs that are optional. And that's how the general the distribution of the cuts were made. Some areas within the department were cut more. Some were increased. Actually, they weren't cut at all, but there was an increase. For example, Pioneer Homes had an increase in their budget. But that's a general philosophy. In the outer years, we have not yet set guidelines for the FY93 budget, except that we know that within the next 6 months, there will be OMB will be going through an analysis of determining on a broader scale where how the budget allocations will be made.
Well, if I might refocus you a little bit here, can you give us, the committee, some ideas of specifically where you think some of these reductions should take place? Obviously, you haven't done all your analysis on it, but specifically, you must have some ideas. I mean, obviously, you consider public radio being one of those things that maybe private business should be doing more in or something. And philosophically, you must have some problem with that because of the large cuts that you proposed there. Can you give us a little idea of where in these 3 years you'll be going with those, where you'll be proposing some cuts? And I know you've given us a general overview, but you haven't opened up your mind for us here so we can see where you might be heading. And that's what I'm trying to get you to.
Specifically in the Department of Administration.
That would be great. Okay. And then if you have ideas on other places, too, that you would be advocating reductions in, we would like to know that also.
Well, I don't have any specific recommendations in other areas. Let me address that one first. The governor's stated goal is to reduce the number of employees using attrition. And I think on an overall basis, that will be one of the basic strategies that we follow, is to try to reduce the number of employees. There are about 2,000 employees that leave state employment voluntarily every year. They retire, resign, or leave for one reason or another. Our plan this year is to reduce the total number of employees by 600. So we're far under the attrition rate. But we see that over the period of years, that streamlining the government should result in a reduction. Now, specifically within the Department of Administration, going in the sequence of events, the programs were constitutionally obligated to provide, legally obligated to provide, and so forth. I would always follow that kind of a realm. Going from the bottom up on things such as public broadcasting, that clearly, in my judgment, is a service that government chooses to provide. It's not we're not legally or constitutionally required to provide grants to public radio or public television. I think public broadcasting is very generously funded by the state government. Our budget proposes over $5 million in grants. That's a reduction from what they had last year. But in the same token, there have been a great number of changes in the marketplace that public broadcasting serves. And I think they have to recognize that they're out there competing in a real market now. They don't, for example, in the area of television, things such some of the cultural programs, children's programs used to be the exclusive area of public television. They no longer are. There are cable offerings that provide some of the same kinds of services. Now, they don't do it to the same extent that public television does, but I think the public broadcasting has to realize that they are now in a more competitive market. Technology has changed the way these things are delivered. It may not be necessary to have as many locations served by standalone employees. For example, if you're in a community that has lots of radio stations, you don't depend on one of those radio stations for the only source of life and safety type information. I think public broadcasting has to recognize that it has that kind of a challenge as well. Public broadcasting has a great deal of support from the citizens of the state, and I believe that the commission, because I don't have any choice in where the grants are provided, the Public Broadcasting Commission has complete independence on where they'll spend the $5 million in grants. And I have complete confidence that they will spread those grants out according to the needs of the communities where the service is provided. So they may, of course, would like to have more money, but I think in the long run, they're going to be better off getting more in line with maintaining a type of spending and programming that's based on the consumers that they serve. The consumers in our system usually pay for the services they want, and if they don't pay for them, they're telling the vendor that they don't want that service, or that they can get it somewhere else at a better cost.
Specifically, then, on public radio, your budget proposed a 30% cut. The House certainly approved a full funding for it. I believe the Senate is on the same track. What will your recommendation be to the governor when the budget is passed, specifically on that item?
We've all determined that we would not ask the governor for more money than was in our original budget. So my recommendation would be to reduce the amount of that budget to what we originally asked for. Obviously, when the governor comes down to making those decisions on reducing items in a budget, there are going to be a lot of other things at play than just what Department of Administration wants. But my recommendation is going to be to not increase the budget that we asked for in the beginning. And that's not just public broadcasting, but that's any other area where our budget got increased.
So if I can put some words in your mouth, then you will recommend to the governor that he veto the 30% out of public broadcasting?
That he reduce it to the $5 million that we asked for.
Okay. Right. So it appeared out of the governor's office in the last week that there may be some change in his thinking. And I think this is an important topic because sometimes it seems like what the governor says and what you say aren't exactly equal. And in fact, if I may be so bold to suggest that there may be some people in the administration that sometimes blame you for not representing the governor's position accurately. Now, I don't know if this is just a way to get the governor off the hook and all everybody under him obviously is a fall guy, or if there may be some differences between you and the governor. So if the governor's office is backing off on this and say maybe they don't deserve a 30% cut, what do you do when that happens, when the governor's office is sending out a different signal than you seem to be sending out? Specifically on that, but there's certainly some others, and we'll get into longevity bonus, for example. But specifically on public radio, does that key anything in your mind as commissioner there that maybe I shouldn't say now that we want a 30% cut, or do you think that you keep a steady course? This was the plan from the beginning. No matter what's coming out of the governor's office itself now, I stick with mine. What's your role there?
I look at my responsibility as taking policy direction from the governor, not from the press. And the governor has not told me that he wants to change his mind on public broadcasting. Just like you, he's an elected official, and he has every right to change his mind if he deems it's appropriate. Sometimes, when things like this are reported, there may be a tendency to try to judge what the press is saying as a way to form public policy. I've never believed that is a sound basis for public policy.
All right. I think just your comments overall bring up a lot of questions I'd like to maybe you think about. You talked about constitutional obligations and also in that legal obligations. And there's some things there that I think we need to explore. But what I'm going to do right now is open it up to the committee here for a little bit and not hog all their time. Representative Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for not hogging all the time. Commissioner, earlier you had said some of the initiatives, such as the bird maintenance. You brought up some of those initiatives, and my question is, would you at any time consider recommending to the governor that the way to get funds for that might be to tap permanent fund earnings, be it the reserves, inflation proofing, or perhaps even a change in the formula of the dividends? Is that something you would consider?
Mr. Chairman, no, I wouldn't. I've always, in fact, I've written several articles and still am strong belief that the permanent fund should not be tapped for any kind of government operation spending or capital spending for that matter. And I think that over the years, the legislature has fallen into the same kind of belief that any use of the permanent fund other than for dividends and inflation proofing is probably going to require a public vote. And I think that's appropriate in my judgment.
So short follow-up, Mr. Chairman. I think I did read that you at one time proposed doubling the permanent fund. Mm-hmm. You still hold that view?
From the time the permanent fund was initiated until the problem that always bothered me about the permanent fund is that there is no defined purpose in the permanent fund. And over the years, in my judgment, we have developed a purpose. And the purpose is to provide dividends. And in thinking about it, I'm not sure that isn't a very noble purpose. One of the things that I think of all the public institutions we have that exemplifies what the owner-state concept is, the permanent fund is the best example we have. Because 500 and some thousand Alaskans have a share of that permanent fund, and they receive a direct benefit, an equal benefit from it, and they own it. They own the permanent fund. And I think there's nothing else that we could say that more typifies what the owner state concept is than the permanent fund. So the when you look at the undistributed income account, which is this right now in the neighborhood of $500 million. That's being saved by the trustees for future inflation proofing so that it won't diminish dividends. I wrote an article one time after doing an analysis of what the future earnings forecast that the trustees are using to justify keeping that $500 million undistributed income in the permanent fund. And the forecast is based on a 3% spread between the rate of inflation and the average earnings of the permanent fund. And if you assume that spread will be 3% in the future, then we will need the undistributed income account over the next 10 years. It'll gradually be eroded by an appropriation for inflation proofing. So I took the permanent fund's numbers and I said, what if the average spread, by the way, over the last 5 years has been closer to 5%, not 3%. So I just did a very simple analysis that said, what happens if the spread is 3.5% or 4% in the future instead of 3%? And somewhere between 3.5% and 4%, which isn't an unreasonable assumption, the permanent fund no longer needs that undistributed income. And particularly, if the half percent comes because the inflation assumptions are lower rather than the interest earnings assumption being lower. So the question would come, if we don't need that $500 million for inflation proofing, what should we do with it? In my judgment, we could distribute the whole thing to the citizens of Alaska in one extra permanent fund. It would be approximately $1,000 one-time dividend. The whole thing could be distributed to the people that own the permanent fund. And that was the article I wrote to show one analysis that would have that effect.
But your underlying assumption there is that the purpose that you have identified of the permanent fund is to provide dividends.
Right.
And I would probably counter that the purpose of the permanent fund is to provide income for the state at such time as our natural resources do not provide that, i.e. the oil runs out. And obviously with two different assumptions of the purpose of the permanent fund, you would have two different results there of what you would do with that money. Representative Bloomberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just ask a few questions following on that point right now. You've indicated, Commissioner, that you tend to follow the Constitution and the statutes and then in the area of budget cutting and cutting non-essential programs. So I would assume in that sense you are what we would call a strict constitutional constructionist. In other words, you look at the Constitution, see what the Constitution says, and try to follow it. Am I right?
Well, we all took the same oath of office. I mean, I took the same oath that you did, and that is that I swore to defend the Constitution and the laws of Alaska. Not that I swore to agree with them, but I swore to defend them.
I'd just like to follow up with respect to the questions on the permanent fund. You stated that you believe it's the purpose of the permanent fund, the purpose, and I emphasize the word the purpose, that language, to provide dividends. And I'm wondering where in the Constitution, where in the legislative history of the permanent fund statutes you find any support for that being the purpose?
No, I think what I said was that there isn't a purpose defined. That's always bothered me, that we don't have a defined purpose that says the purpose of the permanent fund is such and such. That doesn't exist, and that's always bothered me that that doesn't exist. But what I was trying to say was that over the years, a purpose has evolved, and I think in the public's mind, there is a purpose for the permanent fund. And I think the purpose of the permanent fund is to provide dividends.
But does the public believe that's the only purpose?
I think if you put it to a vote and you said, should the permanent fund be used to provide dividends? Should the permanent fund be used to divide dividends and endow government spending? That you would get a landslide on the first question. And then you would lose the second one.
How about if you were to phrase it, do you believe that the purpose is to provide dividends and also provide a means of financing government when the revenues drop?
I think you lose on that one, too.
Do you believe that you are one of the trustees of the permanent fund?
That's right.
Are you taking it then as your policy, as a trustee, under those conditions, that the only purpose of the permanent fund is to provide dividends?
Well, not the only purpose. I should say there are two purposes for the earnings that are in law right now. One is inflation proofing and the other is dividends.
Are those the only purposes?
Right now, by default, I think they are the only purposes. And until there is legislation that actually articulates a purpose of the permanent fund, the trustees are working on the assumption that what we're supposed to do with the earnings is inflation-proof and provide dividends.
So everything that's not needed for inflation-proofing should be immediately distributed to the people.
You should
not try to build up the corpus of the fund.
No, we are building up the corpus of the fund.
Through
inflation proof.
Yes, I think you and I understand what my question is. My question is, should building up the corpus be limited simply to inflation proofing?
No, the other source, the major source, in fact, is royalty, is 25% to 35% of the royalties. That's the major source of income, although that's getting to be now, inflation proofing is now, I think inflation proofing now exceeds or is almost equal to the amount that we get from royalty income for the permanent fund. So the corpus is being built by plowing back almost half the earnings and allowing the constitutional contribution from the royalties.
Are you articulating the views of only yourself, or is that also the views of the other members of the new Board of Trustees? Have you discussed this?
At our board meeting, we've discussed this, yeah.
Are you speaking only for yourself, or is that representative use?
Well, you asked, those are my views. I could provide you the minutes of the meeting. I'm not sure that it was very clear in my mind that the trustees concur with the legislative mandate of providing inflation proofing and dividends as the our major purposes, or the use of the earnings. We also have a strong interest, of course, in the performance of the fund, to make sure that it performs well and returns to the owners better rate of return. We'd like to see the fund perform better than it has in the past.
We've been discussing your role as a trustee on the permanent fund, as well as being the commissioner of administration. You sit as a trustee on the permanent fund. What other ex officio boards and commissions?
The state bond committee, which also I think is a very critical overlooked function of government, because the whole question of state debt and municipal debt and university debt is a very problematic condition right now, given the fact that our debt is tied to the decline curve of Prudhoe Bay. And so the ability of local governments, university, and the state government to incur debt is substantially affected. The student loan committee is another seat that I have, that I serve directly on. I'm also on the prison industry, it's the thing that builds the correction, yeah, and I've delegated that to somebody else, to our general services people, to sit on that one.
Anything else?
Nothing that's had a meeting yet that I can recall.
It sounded like, from your original answers to the chairman's questions, that you are, in fact, among the people who are involved in one of the architects of the governor's fiscal policy. Is that accurate to state, too?
Well, from the very beginning, the governor wanted me to work closely with Shelby Stastny to fashion our budget proposal and to review the budgets of all the departments. I think in the past there's always been a review panel of two or three commissioners that reviewed all the budgets. So we did that. I was on that panel.
And with respect to setting the goal of $1.7 billion and a 5% reduction per year, would you say that you were the architect of that?
No, no, that is clearly something the governor has talked about for many years, that we should adjust in terms of the owner state. And then this all comes from a very strong belief that the governor has regarding the proper role of government in developing the resources and in the stewardship of those resources, that the operation of government should be funded by taxes, licenses, and fees, that we should not use our wealth income to fund the operation of government. That's been something that an idea that he developed, and in our plan, the spending plan that we've laid out for 4 years, is to achieve that goal by the fourth year.
I'll pass it this
way. Thank you. Let me lead you in a direction here. Let's talk about SBS for a while. Obviously, this SBS system, we all know there's been some financial difficulty. There has been some investments made that were made in junk bonds, unsecured, where a possibility of losing $130 million plus. My understanding is that the governor already has a legal opinion that states that it is not the government does not have an obligation to make that fund whole. Would you comment on that, please?
Well, we don't have any legal opinion. We're working on a legal opinion right now to resolve that very issue, what is the obligation of the government to either bail out SBS or to try to defend itself against a lawsuit if it doesn't bail out SBS, because that's what we're convinced will happen.
The governor does not have a legal opinion at this time?
No, we've asked the Attorney General contracted with an outside law firm for an opinion. They received a draft opinion last week.
They have a draft opinion.
They have a draft opinion, but it's more complicated because we originally asked for two opinions. and one of the firms had to decline because of a conflict with one of the parties that maybe we may end up in litigation with. And as a result, we only got one of the two opinions that the Attorney General was going to use to try to fashion what the state's final legal position is.
When an opinion is asked for by the governor, do they say, I'd like an opinion, and I'd like you to take this tack or that tack? Or did they say, would you give me your honest judgment on this question? In other words, I guess I'm saying that a lawyer can argue, I mean, in a court, can always go one way or the other, and that's what they do. They argue both sides.
The reason we asked for, the Attorney General wanted two opinions, was the firms were given essentially the same criteria. These are what we need your opinion on. The constitutional issue on reducing retirement benefit, the legal issue on whether the state had done an adequate job of investing and following good, prudent practices during the years 87 through 89 when they were buying these GICs. And then, in addition to that, they asked one of the firms to consider if you had to defend the participants, in other words, the PERS board and the participants in SPS, and the other firm was to take into consideration if you had to defend the state general fund. And that's why we wanted the two opinions that would essentially be, could be laid side by side, but one that would tend to represent, or at least to take into consideration defending the state and the other suing the state.
And so my question wasn't as really as funny as it might have sounded. You do try to direct things on. What is the draft opinion gist of it? Which way is it heading?
Well, I can share that with you in an executive session, but I can't do it here because there are very significant litigation issues involved in terms of us suing and being sued.
Fair enough. What do you think the moral position is of the state? And do you take moral positions as Commissioner of Administration?
Well, I think all of us have moral and ethical principles that we follow. So certainly those persons, all of a person's values come from moral and ethical beliefs. So I do, to that extent, follow those sort of things. As far as the state's concerned, though, in my judgment, it's more of a legal legal decision. We're here to represent, in my judgment, the public. I mean, that's our. If you have to choose sides between the public and the employees, and we very rarely are asked to choose sides, but occasionally we are, then my belief is that our oath was to the citizens of Alaska, and that we have to serve their interests when it comes to some unfortunate decision that we may have to make. Certainly, we have to take into consideration, and they're not just state employees, by the way, they're in SBS. There are some political subdivisions that are also in the SBS program. So this thing goes broader than just state employees.
You have taken a position, basically an opposition to, I believe it's Senate Bill 18,
right?
Senator Schill's mm-hmm. bill, that sets up an oversight board, actually takes it out of revenue's hands. And how does this change this situation with SBS? Does that change your mind at all?
No, our opposition, by the way, is on the composition of the board, not on the need for some kind of oversight. And we've testified that effect. We, Department of Revenue believes that there's a need for more oversight. Right now, the Commissioner of Revenue has the sole fiduciary responsibility, almost sole fiduciary responsibility, for doing investments of all of the PERS and TERS funds, which are $5 or $6 billion, plus the SBS. Now we have an interim agreement with the SBS investments. In law, those SBS investments are actually under Department Administration.
Under your
right.
care.
But now, our problem is with the composition of the board.
All right. Well, let me pursue this then. On the one hand, you're questioning whether you have a legal obligation to pay these funds back to make that system whole.
Right.
Yet, on the other hand, you're arguing that, it seems like you're arguing the other side of the story in opposing this setting up this council to invest those funds. You seem to be saying, we don't have a legal obligation, we may not have a legal obligation to replace those funds, but over here you're arguing, we don't want to set up this commission to handle those funds because we may have a legal obligation.
No, I'm sorry if I...
And you said earlier, excuse me, that the state, that the people that are putting in that money are the ones that really have the vested interest in that fund as much or more so than the people that are going to receive that fund, i.e. the employers. So they seem to be inconsistent positions.
Well, I don't think they're inconsistent. Let me try to clarify, because if I said something that led... first of all, I see them as different issues rather than being one issue with inconsistent positions. It's my belief on the composition of the board that all of the boards and commissions that we appoint, that the governor appoints and that serve, should ultimately be accountable to the public. And the only way under our Constitution that they can be accountable to the public is if they're accountable to the governor. Because the only way the public can change a board is to change the governor. And the governor can change a board. Now, we have lots of boards and commissions that we've isolated from the public. Because changing the governor doesn't have the ability to change many of the boards and commissions that we have. So if the public is unhappy with the operation of a board, they have no way of changing it. And I don't think that's right. It is allowed in the Constitution for us to do that. So it's not a constitutional issue. It just, I don't think that that's the best way, given the way we have the executive branch organized with only one elected official. If we wanted to isolate boards and commissions, then we should consider changing our Constitution, in my judgment, to elect the people that serve on those kind of boards and commissions. And that way the public would be able to hold a board or commission accountable. Many states do that. Our state is unique. I think there are only two other states that only have one elected person in the executive branch. But many states have boards and commissions that are elected by the public, including things like a board of education, or a board of public welfare, or a board of transportation, and so forth.
Attorney General.
And in many cases, there are other people elected too, attorney general, auditor, sometimes a commissioner of education, and so forth. But so that's, in terms of the composition of boards, that's why, and our only opposition on Senate Bill 18 is on the composition of the board. That board is not accountable to the public. In fact, it's not even accountable to the political subdivisions that are going to have, may have a majority of the members in PERS and TERS. It's going to be accountable to employee groups once it's appointed. And I just philosophically have a disagreement with that. There is another bill that Representative Larson introduced that does the same thing, provides the oversight in terms of, because we agree with the oversight, the need for the oversight and so forth. But in his bill, the board, the oversight board, is accountable to the public through the governor. So that's the mechanism that we prefer. So I think it really comes down to a policy call. And I've talked to Senator Porcheau about this many times, in fact, in terms of trying to explain our position and him explaining his position.
Will you recommend a veto the way the bill stands right now?
I won't personally recommend a veto without talking to the Commissioner of Revenue, because the bill affects him, not me.
Well, somewhat. I believe it's an SBS also, which you're responsible for right now.
Well, to the extent that we have delegated the SBS investments to the Commissioner of Revenue, so we, for the last year, the Department of Administration has not been responsible for investing in SBS. But I would lean heavily on what the Commissioner of Revenue believes, because I don't think, for example, my beliefs on the composition of the board and the accountability of the board should be the sole determinant. If the Commissioner of Revenue needs this and the governor is comfortable with the board, then I would have no problem supporting that.
Who handles the applications for withdrawals out of SBS right now? Is that through your department then? So you're not handling the investment, but you're still handling the fund.
Right.
Have you had requests for withdrawals since this situation, since you've been in office, mm-hmm. and that you have not handled, that are not being processed? Could you tell me how you're going to deal with this?
Here's where we stand. This is a very significant issue, and it's a very appropriate question, because we're in the process of sending out letters today to all legislators explaining the situation. the way withdrawals, first of all, you have to be retired to get your money out of SBS. Active employees, you can't take your money out as long as you're an active employee.
Except for emergency, I think there's exceptions.
There may be, but I'm not aware of it if there is. The way withdrawals come in two forms. A retired person, 90 days after they leave public employment, can ask to have a lump sum withdrawal of their SBS funds, or they can ask to have the funds that are in there turned into an annuity. And both things happen. And there's different ways you can have the annuity if you want to do that. But what happens is the requests come into the retirement benefits division, and they accumulate these requests over a period of a month, and they have to check to make sure that you retired at least, your termination date is at least 90 days ago, and there are various processes, checking the balance and so forth. And once a month, that distribution list is sent to New York Life, who's now doing the SBS disbursements, and they either create the annuity if somebody wants to turn their SBS into a New York Life annuity, or they disperse the funds if it's a lump sum distribution, and the state sends does a wire transfer to New York Life to provide them the funds. The current list that we're working on is the March-April list, and normally those distributions would take place about now, about this week. We'd be sending the list to New York Life. We were advised last week by Deloitte Touche, the accounting firm that does the accounting, provides accounting advice for the PERS board, that given the extraordinary events that have taken place at Executive Life since April 1st, that we should not distribute the full amount of those without reflecting on our policies that take, and those policies should take into account the questionable investments in Executive Life. What those extraordinary events are is that on April 1st, Executive Life provided their 10K report, which is an annual report that all insurance companies have to give to the federal government, and it lays out all of the accounting details for the year, including the performance on their investments. Up until that time, there had been a lot of press regarding what was going to happen, but when the 10K was made official on April 1st, it showed a huge loss at Executive Life. On the 11th of April, the California Insurance Commissioner stepped in and took over control of Executive Life. In the insurance business, they call it the conservatorship. In any other business, we call it Chapter 11, but it's essentially insurance companies don't use that kind of jargon. Right now, and that fundamentally changed anybody who had an Executive Life investment as soon as the California Commissioner steps in and takes over, because the California Commissioner has the ability to freeze any distributions out of Executive Life. And so anybody that is holding Executive Life investments has to reflect that. This is what the accountants told us, has to reflect the fact that you no longer have an unfettered claim on these assets. Well, what that's going to mean is that now that we have this knowledge in hand, the accountants have told us, you can't just keep distributing as if you didn't know that there was the possibility you have some impaired assets. And so we're going to work in the, and we presented this to the PERS board last week, the situation. They want to meet on May 3rd and formulate a new policy regarding how we're going to handle distributions. We will be distributing. I mean, that's the problem isn't that we're not going to distribute, do any lump sum distributions. It's just that we're going to have some policy that takes into account this approximately 20% of the SBS assets that are associated with Executive Life.
Commissioner, you seem to indicate that this decision was made on April 11th. Have applications for withdrawal as far back as December, January, been approved, and those withdrawals have been made?
Mm-hmm. Through March. I think the list we're working on now is the... Yeah.
On the full cost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The reason I pushed that one is that we had some indications that that was not true, that some of those, or possibly all of those, were not being paid out.
but they are.
As far as I know, I mean, if you have some different, as far as I know, the March list, which would have been the February, March requests for lump sum distributions, were processed normally and have been processed. Now, the only thing that does
for payment.
Yeah. The only time that comes into account is that if you've retired, you have to wait 90 days before you can request. So if somebody left the state employment in December, January, February, they won't even be allowed to request withdrawal until 90 days have passed.
Do you have a time limit that you have to respond or pay that out? If they can't ask for it for 90 days, if they ask for it 90 days, does the administration have to pay it out within 30 days or 60 days or 90-something?
I asked that same question last Friday, and I believe that we have 90 days to respond to a request. Over the years, the practice has been to do it on these 30-day, to just accumulate the requests over a 30-day period and then handle them all at once. But that's part of what we're going to do when we fashion a recommendation to the PERS board, is to lay out what the current regulation policies and practices are, and what our recommendations for changes are.
If there's a problem with applications, if somebody is turned down for some reason, or are they immediately notified? Is there a process in there so that people know what's going on with their requests?
Well, they should be. Again, if you have examples where they aren't notified, forward them to me and I'll find out, because I will follow up on all those. But right now, they have an extraordinary number of phone calls. In fact, I went down to retirement benefits on Thursday to actually be there when the phone calls come in and see the nature of what's happening. And they have, as you can imagine, what they'll do, you can call up. I don't want to encourage people to do this, because if you go down there and see what they're going through right now.
Probably a mess.
You can call up, and they'll tell you what the balance, what your current SBS balance is. They can't promise that that's what you're going to get paid, of course, because until we get these regulations in place, we don't know how much of that can be paid out. They can tell you whether you're on the April list or the May list or the June list and that sort of thing. In other words, if you put in your request now, you're on the May list. So they can tell you if you're on that list, if you're concerned that you put in a request, you don't know whether it's been processed or not. And then, unfortunately, a lot of people kind of unload on them for these investment decisions that were made, and that comes with the territory. And you talk to employees that do that, and they try to be as courteous as possible, provide as much information as they can. And I've told them at the point that they cannot respond, that I will call back, and I've done that with on many of these, where a person just didn't get an answer, and I'll call back and talk to a participant that's concerned about where we're going.
Just creating a morale problem within the state employees?
I don't think it's a morale problem as much as I would put it more in the stress category. I mean, it's a very difficult thing to spend a whole day, as you know, because I'm sure you have constituent phone calls that sound very much like this. So you probably have a lot of sympathy for what they're going through.
When will you make a decision and on the whether to cover this fully or partially?
We hope by the May 3rd PERS board meeting that we'll have the Attorney General's opinion as to what we're going to do, recommendation regarding our legal position. That then is going to require us, or besides the legal opinion, is the legislation that we've introduced, which is the bailout bill. There's a bill in the House and a bill in the Senate.
And you support those still?
If the legal opinion is that the...
So they're on hold, in other words.
They're on hold. And I think the legislators, the Finance Committee, is on hold as well, because without the legal opinion, we don't know whether the bill is needed or not. If the legal opinion says that the state can't defend itself and that we're stuck with the bad investments, then the bill is going to be necessary, because what the bill allows, in effect, the bill provides the general fund to make an imprudent investment. And that imprudent investment is to buy the GIC contracts from SBS and give SBS $132 million in cash. Now, there are other things that we might be able to work out of this. And we're investigating all kinds of alternatives as part of the bailout. If we get stuck with the bailout, there's ways that we can come up with a defeasement schedule that might not hurt the state so bad. There's other ways that we might be able to mitigate some of the downside.
The record should show that we have been joined from time to time by other representatives. Representative Davidson has been here, Representative Phillips. We're now joined by Representative Brown, who was also here earlier. Representative Bloomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just following up on this point. You said, essentially, Commissioner, that you would not be inclined to, I'll say, bail out SBS unless there were a legal obligation to do so. Am I correct?
That's right.
Yet earlier in your testimony today, one of the things that at least my notes indicate you said was that you would use the royalty wealth of the state to spend on retiring state debt, including the moral obligation of school debt. Why would you retire, use state funds for one type of obligation that's a moral obligation and not for this type?
Well, in the case of the school district debt, the state, through law, said to school districts, we'll pay 80% of the bill on your debt. And then on that basis, school districts went out and incurred a huge amount of debt. I think the state has that obligation, that moral obligation, to do that. And in fact, the state has been funding this debt service out of the state's general fund. So the debt reimbursement. There was no such obligation or no such commitment made on the state employee retirement system. In fact, the SBS system is very much like the 401 plans, investment plans that many employers provide, larger employers provide. And there's no guarantee that 401s always make money. And in fact, sometimes they lose money. And employees have been hurt when their employer made some bad investments in a 401 plan. So on those kind of plans, in the private sector, you sometimes win and you sometimes lose. So that I don't see the same kind of moral obligation on the part of the employer.
Are you familiar, Commissioner, with Article 12, Section 7 of the state constitution?
Right. Yeah, that's
which states membership in employee retirement systems of the state or its political subdivisions shall constitute a contractual relationship. Accrued benefits of these systems shall not be diminished or impaired.
Right.
And the case of State Israel Hammond versus Allen, which states that the EPORs, talking about the elected public officers' retirement system, or EPORs, constitutes a contractual relationship between participants in that program and the state, which must be honored by the state. Doesn't that, to take it out of the 401k category and put it at least in the moral obligation category?
That is exactly what the legal opinion is going to determine. Thanks. The issues that the firms have been asked to address are the constitutional provision that you cited, and the possible liability that we might have for the quality of investments that were made. And that's what I'm saying. The Attorney General is going to make that call, and that's exactly the legal opinion. The opinion is: can we defend if we were sued on that provision?
I think
we're saying the same thing, that we are going to make this decision on the basis of that provision in the Constitution. I'm not prepared at this point to say that SBS is, first of all, or applies to all the criteria that are there. It's a very compelling case, of course, because and that's why we're concerned.
I understand that's what you're saying, Commissioner, and that's one of the things that I'm saying, and that's what I've been focusing on. I'd like to shift the focus slightly, but importantly, on what policy basis, other than those you've articulated, should the state have a moral obligation to a school district that is higher in this respect, that is higher than its moral obligation to its employees?
Well, in this particular case, as far as debt service, the moral obligation is that the state in law said, we will reimburse up to 80% of your debt and then had school districts go out and incur a great amount of debt. Now, in my judgment, there is, in the past, the legislature hasn't been required to fully fund that debt reimbursement. In fact, in most cases, hasn't reimbursed the full amount of its moral obligation.
And couldn't constitutionally.
Right. Actually, you could do zero. I mean, you're not required to do this. But there was a moral obligation, in my judgment, made when that law was passed. And that subsequent events that school districts incurred $600 million in debt as a on the basis of that. But the pledge here on the state employees, unless there's a statute that you can see that says that the state will guarantee that the employees make so much on their SBS investments, and I am not aware of any guarantee or pledge that we've made in law to guarantee that the SBS investments always succeed.
I understand what you're saying, and I'm going one step farther. You have said, basically, and I'm not talking about a legal argument now, I'm talking about a policy argument. I'm trying to find out what your view of state policy should be. That there is, in fact, a what we'll call a reliance or a detrimental reliance by school districts on the fact that they have a reasonable expectation that the state would repay them this money based upon certain actions we've taken as a state government. Not quibbling with that. I want to focus on the position of the state employees, many of whom, all of whom are individual, small people, individual people, who have changed their lives more or less dramatically by putting a significant amount of their small paychecks into this SBS program. Doesn't the state have every bit as great a moral responsibility to them as it does to these large school districts?
Well, this is where I said we're in one of those unfortunate situations where we as policymakers have to consider our representation of the public and the employees and decide where the dividing line is, because we're also here to protect the public's general fund from unnecessary or unauthorized or unwarranted expenditures. And I, in my judgment, that's a public policy call. I don't see it as a right and wrong call. I can fully respect a person's opinion who says the state should bail out the employees. There's a moral obligation. We don't want to see employees hurt and so forth. But on the other hand, I can also respect the opinion of somebody who says, I'm here to represent the public. And when it comes to a point where I have to decide whether my representing the public's general fund is more important than bailing out some employee investments, that I'm, as much as I hate to do it, I'm going to have to defend the public.
I understand. And let me just, I really want to direct the answer. What is your position on this? How will you advise the governor? What's the right thing to do here?
Well, in my judgment, it's a legal decision. I couldn't make it clearer. It's not just an ad hoc decision. I think this, we have to recognize what is our legal obligation to the citizens of the state. And once we decide that, then it's easy to make the policy call, in my judgment. I mean, it's a very difficult decision either way you go, because you're either going to take the money out of the public's general fund, which is their money, or you're going to see the employees lose some of their investment, which is their money. So there isn't going to be a winner. I mean, we'll never come with a win-win out of this unless we're able to recover or somehow reduce the amount of damage that gets done.
So you would not make a decision based on a moral basis. If there's no legal obligation, then the employees, in your opinion, would just be out of luck.
I'm not sure I understood that question.
Well, let me say it again.
Because yeah, I'm saying there is, where I'm starting with the basis that there is a legal decision that's made, and because I'm not going to make the policy recommendation until the legal position. So we can argue, as I see it, two ways. If the legal opinion says that the state doesn't have to bail out the employees, mm-hmm. in other words, that constitutional provision doesn't apply, and so forth, then I would say that I'm going to have to opt to protect the citizens' general fund and not bail out SBS.
Thank you.
And I want to go on to some other subjects, but I got to hit something. We seem to talk about the public and the public's defending the public, and it reminds me of the same discussion that's going on with the settlement with Exxon. that we're defending the public by not releasing the study. And obviously, by defending the public, we're fighting segments of the public. And here you seem to be saying, we're going to defend the public, but what you're, the consequence of that will be to be fighting again a segment of that public. And they seem to contradict each
other. Well, other than, I think Lincoln tried to define that at one time by pleasing all of the people some of the time, and some of the people all the time. And that's, I think that was a very astute observation as to what will never happen, or what is possible and what is not possible.
Representative Brown.
I just wanted to pursue that line of thinking as to how it would affect your other decisions that we have to make around here to take money, public money, out of the general fund and spend it for various purposes that are not legal obligations of the state. For example, there's now a bill pending that would make mammogram coverage and insurance policies mandatory, would have a fiscal note, and would cost the general fund of the state something to provide a benefit for state employees. Would you apply the same rationale that you've stated, that is, if it's not a legal obligation, you don't think it's warranted to take it out of the general fund, to other decisions, or is this SBS a unique case where you would only or primarily look to a legal obligation?
Well, in this particular case, the obligation would occur if the legislation passed and the appropriation passed and the appropriation made it through the veto process and the legislation made it through the veto process. Then it's on the books, it's funded, and at that point that we have an obligation to essentially fulfill, and I'm not sure that that's really a moral question at that point.
Representative Grunberg was pursuing with you what your recommendations would be and how you view the problem. And I believe you stated that you view it as a legal matter, whether we have a legal obligation. And if so, we do it. And if we didn't, your recommendation
right.
would be that the general fund should not bear that cost.
Right.
So when you approach other public policy decisions, I just gave one example of a public policy decision that's now pending before us, on which your department will be an advisor. You and your representatives will help determine the outcome of that public policy issue. Is this same approach, the legal obligation being the highest requirement and other things not being worthy of being funded by the general fund, is that the approach you're going to take on other policy issues?
Well, first of all, the situation with SBS is entirely different. I don't think you can just say the situation we're faced with SBS is that we're going to be sued regardless of what we do, whether we bail it out or whether we don't bail it out. I believe the state's going to be sued. And so we have to be prepared to defend ourselves. And that's why we need the legal opinion. On the case of the mammogram, I don't think we're going to be sued if we do it or if we don't do it. So it's the dynamics of that decision making on that issue are completely different than the SBS decision.
Representative Bloomberg, on that one?
I would just like to pursue what Representative Brown has been, the path we've started down here. We're not talking about mammograms here. We're not talking about SBS. We're talking about your own views and your own philosophies and what you believe the moral obligation and the philosophy of the state should be. Because as you have said, we have a strong executive type of constitution in this state. That gives each department head a lot of authority and a lot of discretion. And that's what we want to explore with you, what your own views are, what your own views of the state's trust responsibilities to its citizens are. And we didn't mean to limit you in your answers. Were you merely using a couple of examples, Commissioner? Would you care to expand on your views?
Well, the examples that I was responding to were ones that were given to me. I thought I was trying to answer a question. It wasn't
sure.
made as a general question.
I make this general question.
I see our obligations. The clearest way for me to understand my obligation is to read and consider my oath of office. I've always thought that is the clearest way to determine. It's a very profound statement that we make when we take the oath. To swear to support and defend the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution and laws of Alaska. It's a very profound statement when you, and the, when the Chief Justice administers that oath to you. And that's what I see the whole moral obligation of public service evolving from that responsibility. We have a system of laws, and we believe strongly in the rule of law. That means that if you believe in the rule of jawboning and that sort of thing, that you're, in effect, betraying the rule of law. So we have to have in place a system based where the government acts based on laws that are in place, and the implementation of those laws, not on the basis of what one person's thoughts, mine included, are regarding whether this is a good idea or a bad idea. Now, there are cases where you're going to have, in the implementation of laws, that you'll make decision judgments on the regulations that go along with them and how you interpret the laws. And a lot of that is based on the craftsmanship of the lawmakers in terms of how they wrote the law and what their intentions were and who had what responsibility. And I think to some extent there are problems there because in many cases the delegations aren't clear. The delegations may be to a commission, for example, rather than to the commissioner. And so it's very difficult to hold to develop clear lines of accountability. But nevertheless, my own personal belief as far as the moral obligation that I have is based on a very strong commitment to the rule of law.
Well, Commissioner, you have, in fact, recognized that as well as the strict adherence to the letter of the law, there is an obligation on the part of state personnel to follow certain philosophies, have you not?
Well, if you're talking about the memo, that's...
That immediately leaps to mind.
I think the response that we made was absolutely clear, that in that we're committed to people that want to serve the citizens of Alaska. The fact that I wasn't very careful in fashioning that phrase to make that clear, and that I wasn't as sensitive as I should have been to... a union's concern that a improperly worded phrase might raise some hackles was my mistake, and I apologize for doing that. But I don't think it changes any moral outlook that I have, or any. And in fact, I don't think anything in that memo or the attachment had any tones associated with it that would be immoral or unethical or improper or anything of that nature.
Was the timing of that memo just coincidental that it came close to the end of the six-month probationary period after Governor Cooper had appointed a number of employees, or was that memo specifically directed at them?
The origin of the memo was based on a question that I had asked about how we do evaluations. In fact, it was a general evaluation question because I've always believed that making sure that you keep up with evaluations of all your employees is a very critical obligation of the executive. And we had found, even in the Department of Administration, that we didn't always keep up with evaluations, that they were supposed to be done on such and such a date, and they might be 30 days late or 60 days late. Well, that's not fair to employees that you're not doing the evaluations at the proper time. Again, I'm a new commissioner, just learning the ropes, learning how this works. So the next question came, well, what do you do in evaluation? What are the criteria that you use to evaluate an employee? I had the experience in how school districts evaluated employees for my service on the school board, but I had never in state government gone through the do's and don'ts, and in particular to make sure that you do it right. You don't want to do things that are improper. Question then became that the methods of evaluating are different for full-time employees and probationary employees. And there was some concern expressed from two or three departments because of the hiring frenzy that had taken place in November in the last days of the Cooper administration. And we were concerned to make sure that proper evaluation processes took place. And so I found out that probationary employees, some have six-month probationary periods, some have one-year probationary periods. And it's based on the level or the range that you're hired at as to whether you're a six-month employee or a 12-month employee. By the time I got finished, I thought this was all new information to me. It was very useful information to me. I thought I would share it with the rest of the commissioners so that they would, because I had gone through the kind of bureaucratic exercise of this is what, how you do it, and this is what you avoid, and to make sure the process is fair. And all good intentions went for naught, unfortunately.
So I take it the long answer to a short question is yes. That it finally was not just coincidental, but it was based upon the fact that certain Cooper hirees' probationary periods were about to come to an end.
No, and I said that in the very beginning. I mean, I don't think we've ever, back in December, that concern came up, and we conducted a review of all the hiring practices of the Cooper administration in the last month. And that was done in December, and a report was done in January and released to the press that clearly showed that a hiring frenzy had taken place in, I believe, three departments. And we were concerned about that. Because
what
it was
those departments?
One was DEC, and I'm not sure what the other two were, but there were that report is, we can dig out the, that was a, it was a press-type statement. We can dig that out for you if you're interested. But it was, I mean, when you looked at all the departments, three of these departments had clearly had inappropriate hiring activity during November.
Mr. Keller, if I may, you have used the term hiring frenzy twice, and you now say inappropriate hiring activity. I'd like to explore those phrases with you. A hiring frenzy conjures up pictures in my mind of man-eating bananas. Charts. How great was this frenzy? How many people were hired?
It wasn't that bad, but it was bad. There were several hundred employees in these three departments, and my recollection is it's in the neighborhood of 200 or 300 employees were hired in November. I think without Governor Cooper saying to Governor-elect Hickel at the time, by the way, I'm hiring 400 employees and handing them over, 300 employees or whatever it turned out to be, and handing them over to you on December 3rd. I would have thought that common courtesy would have been, before a governor launches any kind of massive effort like that, that he would have at least let Governor Hickel have the opportunity to say, why don't you just wait? They're going to work on my watch. I'd like to hire them. And that's what we were concerned about. And so that's why we spent some time looking to see where it had, which departments it had occurred in, so that we could at least have some knowledge of what had gone on. And when we did the report, it showed that what I would consider very inappropriate action on the part of the departing governor. And I would be just as critical if it was Governor Hickel who did it in the last, in the waning weeks of his administration. I know for a fact that he would never do that, because of just having worked with him over the years. That's not a nice, clean way to hand off an administration to the next governor.
Thank you all.
Acting Chairman, along with Representative Brown.
Well, on that point, do you consider it inappropriate for the last administration to have followed through what were, in fact, authorized and funded positions by the legislature and directions of the legislature? And I'm familiar with the positions that were hired at DEC and the reasons for them having been included in the budget. And I guess I'm puzzled as to why you feel that it's inappropriate for the past administration to have followed through on the legislative direction.
I think just as a courtesy that a governor would recognize that the incoming governor should make those determinations. There's going to be a new commissioner, for one thing. The outgoing commissioner is, in effect, fulfilling his agenda and then handing that over to a new commissioner. So just at the commissioner level, there should have been some courtesy provided to say, look, we've got this plan in place. The applications are out here. The people, the names are here. This is what we're doing, and you can have at it on December 3rd. But just to do something like this in the last gasp of an administration, I thought was very inappropriate.
Okay.
Please.
Do you really envision that incoming commissioners, per se, would have been involved in these particular hiring decisions, most of which were not in the commissioner's offices, but rather in the line programs of the agency. Why would the commissioner have anything to say about that in terms of the specific individuals being hired?
I believe you go back and look at the people that were hired, DEC is doing this, just studying the whole range, and you'll find case after case of an inappropriate management decision. The need for looking at technical skills as opposed to administrative skills. I don't think there's any question that Commissioner Sandor was handed a very inefficient department that he now has to sort out as a result of this, including making sure that you have the appropriate skills, engineering, scientific-type skills in scientific jobs, and you don't have engineers that are spending most of their time doing word processing and that sort of thing. I mean, just, I don't know, I haven't had all the detail and gone into and actually conducted a detailed review of all of these various things, but I'm convinced that Commissioner Sandor is going to take a great deal of time just essentially reorganize.